I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Jazz trumpet player Dizzy Gillespie was a snappy dresser who wore natty suits, bow ties, berets, and sported a goatee and dark-rimmed glasses. Duke Ellington and his band members dress up for their concerts sporting tailored tuxedos. We remember Billie Holiday for her haunting voice and also the white gardenia that she wore in her hair. Louis Armstrong's music has been enjoyed through the ages, and his wool coat was his signature piece of clothing. Our guest Alfonso McLennan explores this intersection of jazz and dress in his book, Fashion and Jazz. He's an assistant professor at Drexel University's Westfall College of Media, Arts, and Design, author of this new book, Fashion and Jazz. He also worked as a fashion designer, product development manager, and accountant. He worked for companies such as VF Corporation, Nautica, Philips Van Heusen, Izod, and 3M. Alfonso McLennan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So are you more interested in fashion or more interested in jazz? What was the spark that got this going?
Well, both. Actually, I enjoy both of them greatly. I think they're both interrelated, and that really was the impetus of this book, Fashion and Jazz. Both are about improvisation, both are about showmanship, and both are about new forms of art expression and really bringing society forward.
So, would you say that jazz musicians did to fashion what they did to music?
Yeah, I think so. They took fashion and they used it to advance in their field and also to spread their music. And then also they used it. They improvised it. So they took fashion that was trending and then they made certain changes to it. And they also, we'll learn later, they used it to kind of solve problems they were facing as in the entertainment industry and in a time when there was racial inequality.
And I do want to pick up on that, but just the idea of with some of these fashion statements like jazz, pushing boundaries, you know, going into sort of new and experimental and improvisational expression.
Yes. Yeah, I think all interesting thing is that a lot of the stuff in the book we're actually seeing today in the 21st century. We see new forms of music that are often uncomfortable to the older generation. And so these new forms of music push, they provoke. And so it allows society to go forward. So we see that with jazz, which a lot of people don't understand that jazz, we kind of think of it as an older classification of music, older genre. It's like grandparents' music.
But
in the 1900s, ragtime was really revolutionary, and it scared a lot of people. And the artists of the ragtime period had to fight for their music to be accepted.
Well, and as you say, going back to ragtime to the 19th century, looking at fashion, it goes from hoop skirts and bustles into what?
So I think around really where my book starts off, although I go to the genesis of the music, which is kind of around the 1700s and during the period of slavery. But really the first key period of jazz is ragtime, which is about 1893. There's records that it was played at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. So really during the late 1890s, ragtime comes on to play. Also, the cakewalk, which we're all familiar with, that dance was done to ragtime music. So it was really kind of a hopping around, a way to improvise, looking very formal in a comical way. So during ragtime, obviously, it's like the shirt waist period, the leg of mutton sleeves, the longer skirts. You would not show your ankles. And then we move into the blues period, where we see people like Bessie Smith, Alberta Hunter, Lucille Bogan really pushing the boundaries of music. They start to talk about songs that discuss sexuality and gender, and they use a lot of metaphors for male genitalia.
Yes,
so we know that is the blues period, and the songs like Till the Cows Come Home by Lucille Bogan or Bessie Smith, I Wild About That Thing.
But do we also see in the fashion that the sort of loosening, I mean, literally just the loosening of clothing, I mean, especially for women, allowing them to move to the music?
Yeah, the main period was really at the beginning, like the late teens, early 1920s, we see that the women are now, the skirt hemlines start to raise above the ankle, they raise to the knee. It was very provocative. at the same time, jazz is coming onto the scene as popular music. Prior to that period, popular music was considered more classical music. So it was not jazz. Jazz kind of like this jazzing up classical music, ragging the time, changing the structure of the music. So yeah, hemlines raised. Women's dresses were much more looser. They allowed movement. Also at the same time, women were changing their roles in society. They were starting to gain the right to vote. And they were, during the First World War, they started to go into the factories when the men were away. So we see at the same time, the change in role of women and their clothing starts to change.
How about for the and we're talking early 20th century here, how about for the men doing jazz, the jazz musicians, how were they dressing?
Yeah, at the beginning, I started about 1900 during the what I call the Dixieland period, or at the end of ragtime, pretty much the code for men men wore suits. Also, in New Orleans around that time period, again, the early 1900s, we start to see that the men, they either wear suits or they start to wear tuxedos. Mm-hmm. And there was a famous club in New Orleans called Tuxedo Hall. And there was a famous jazz band, the original Tuxedo Jazz Band, and they developed their name from Tuxedo Hall. And so tuxedos really started to become very important. It allowed the early Dixieland jazz bands to play more important venues.
Because they sort of looked better in
a way. They looked better. Typically, you were either like a marching band or you played more what we call formal venues, so balls, maybe steamboat dances. And so when they started wearing tuxedos, it also allowed them to make more money.
Ah.
And so when I went to the Tulane University, the Hogan Jazz Archive, I saw specific amounts about how much more they would make. You might make $10 for lower venues, and then you can make as much as $25 a performance for more formal venues. And that would require wearing a tuxedo.
And jumping ahead, we think of Count Basie and his orchestra. I mean, the very lovely tuxedos that they were wearing.
Yeah, and we almost see it, and I say it becomes almost, it was ordered dress, meaning that I looked at contracts also that required between the orchestra leader or the band leader and their members. Members had to follow certain guidelines of dress and behavior, what they could do on the bandstand. Could they smoke? Could they talk while they're performing? So this wasn't just like they all put on tuxedos. It was very contractual and ordered by the orchestra leader. And I say in the book that the orchestra leaders were actually what I call distributing or disseminating fashion. And they also had control of it. So they were players in the whole fashion system of how designers develop clothes. They give it to retail stores. So in a sense, these orchestra leaders were really creating demand.
You have a wonderful quote from Louis Armstrong. This is, he says, "I was getting dressed, putting on my old roast beef, P.S. That was what we called an old ragged tuxedo. Of course, I had it all pressed up and fixed so good that no one would ever notice it unless they were real close and noticed the patches here and there. Anyway, I was real sharp, at least I thought I was." Anyway,
yes.
Talking about his tuxedo.
Yeah. When Louis left New Orleans, he went to Chicago, and he came from pretty much a poor background. He worked in the red light district, handing out coal to the prostitutes in the red light district. So when he got to New Orleans, he was kind of mentored by some greats that left New Orleans. And again, he had to wear tuxedos, and he didn't have the money at the time. So, you know, they would just repair their one tuxedo they had, and, you know, it had patches on it, but nobody in the audience knew. But the great thing about that quote is it shows how important our appearance and dress, the role that it can play to society and to the audience. So Louis Armstrong, and just that one quote, he kind of authorizes the importance of dress. And what we as fashion scholars say is that dress and appearance is critical in society. It's our way of communicating with other human beings. It often tells them a little bit about us, as far as it could tell about your race, it could tell about your sexuality, it could tell about your gender, it can the way you dress can make people scared. It can make people feel comfortable. So dress is a very important part of society.
And I got the feeling reading through your book and reading some of these quotes is that a lot of these musicians were checking each other out to see what the other musicians were wearing.
Yes, there was
a little competition there, maybe?
Yeah, there was friendly competition, not only with how they dressed, but also in the titles of their bands. There's a section of the book where I talk about how each band was trying to up the other band with titles such as All Star, Hot Five, Hot Six, Chocolate Bo Brummels, the Original Dandies. And I mentioned to a few of my classes earlier this month that I said that's the social media of the early 1900s.
Absolutely. The tweets, right?
Yes, the tweets, their version of the tweets. And again, what we're doing in the 21st century is nothing new. They didn't have the technology during that time period, but they had to still brand themselves, much the way a Kanye West or Kim Kardashian would have to brand herself. The Louis Armstrong, Bessie Smith, they branded themselves.
In fact, I was thinking about Bessie Smith, the Empress of the Blues, the dresses that she wore, the kind of headdresses that she wore. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, Bessie Smith is, this month in May, Queen Latifah will be playing Bessie Smith on HBO. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. Bessie Smith was born with pretty much to abject poverty in Tennessee, and she started performing on street corners, I think in Memphis. And then that pretty much started to catapult her to working with Ma Rainey and touring in what we call the TOBA circuit, which was the Theater Owners Booking Association. That was like a black organization that booked all black acts in each city. And so it kind of provided them a place where they could stay because this was a Jim Crow era. So you couldn't just go into town and think you were going to stay in the hotel. So they would set up places in black communities where the artists could stay. And so that's really how Bessie started her career. And then she became very successful, obviously, in the 1920s, making at a high of $2,500 a week. Yeah.
Wow.
And she realized early on, even coming from abject poverty, how important dress would be to her audiences. She was also performing in the South frequently. And so you had audiences that were down and out and suffering from Jim Crow. So they came to a Bessie show not only to hear great blues music, but also to see something aspirational. And so Bessie did that. She entertained them not only through song, but also through fabulous headdresses, wearing a lot of fringe, feathers, which was the style in the early 1920s. And that was kind of when Oriental flair kind of influenced women's flash fashion.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Alfonso McClendon about fashion and jazz. That's the title of his new book. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We'll be right back.
To go, and ain't nobody gonna hold me down. Say, listen, boy, hurry up and send me, let me go to town.
Look at me, I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree. And I feel like I'm clinging to a cloud I can't understand. I get misty just holding your hand.
And that's Sarah Vaughan singing Misty. We're talking again with Alfonso McClendon about his new book, Fashion and Jazz. Excuse me, Fashion and Jazz. Can you talk a bit about Sarah Vaughan and what she brought to the world of fashion through her jazz?
Yeah, Sarah Vaughan, she comes a little bit later. So she's after Billie Holiday, after Bessie Smith. And she brings more of a contemporary edge. I say she's kind of like the crossover, coming in around the 1940s and then kind of taking us into like R&B. Right. And once a lot of the jazz greats started to depart. So she has some interesting stories about, her interactions with some of the greats, you know, like Billie Holiday. You know, they, again, as we discussed with the men, there was a lot of competition. So sometimes when the women would meet one another, it was kind of unusual circumstances or a different type of maybe not so friendly all the time. I know Bessie Smith.
You're choosing your words very carefully
Bessie
here.
Bessie Smith had encounters with Ethel Waters, and she said, you know, no one's going to sing this song except me. And so there's, you know, friendly competition. But in the end, I think they all wanted one another to do well and succeed.
You mentioned Billie Holiday, and we heard that piece of Billie Holiday going into the break. Known for this white gardenia, how did that start for her?
Yeah, in interview, she always said, she says that she started wearing it. She said it was kind of a childish thing. She thought she couldn't go on without wearing it, that she couldn't perform, that she couldn't sing quite right. So it's
like a good luck?
Yeah, like a good luck. And I say it has a little bit of fetish-like meaning, too, later on. So really, the gardenia, she wore it primarily in the 1940s. So if you look at any images of her, she always has on the white gardenia. Sometimes she would wear an orchid. So she wore orchids also. By the 1950s, she had really stopped wearing the gardenia. So what lives in popular culture is Billie Holiday, the elegant, beautiful, regal Billie Holiday with the gardenia. But really, if you look at valuable photos from the 1950s, she had stopped wearing the gardenia. She was wearing her hair short. And then about the late 50s, probably about 4 years before she died, she started wearing a ponytail. So she had transitioned into what I say more the youth movement, which was about the late 1950s, about a ponytail. And so her very last set of images is all with the ponytail, no gardenia. So I always say in my book, on the chapter on Billie Holiday, I really wanted to paint the full narrative of Billie Holiday. She went through, I say, a 30-year period, and each 10-year period, it was slightly different, her style. So,
well, in fact, you say when she went through her period of drug addiction, she started wearing long gloves, and in many ways it was to cover up the tracks.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote a chapter in another book called Fashionable Addiction, The Path to Heroin Chic. We know that in the late 1990s, the heroin chic style became fashionable in the garment industry, and we used it. The look of being drugged, the look of having recently done heroin. So the models became stylish. So models would darken their eyes. They would walk on the runways in a lethargic manner,
and looking obviously very skinny.
Yeah, looking very emaciated. So this is when really skinny models became very popular in the industry, in the fashion industry. Prior to that, it was what we call the Cindy Crawford look. Elle McPherson, where the models looked healthy and they were more full. They were more full figure, not full figure, but they had more weight on them than what we still see to this day is really skinny models are still in vogue.
Yeah.
So I continue that chapter of Fashionable Addiction in this book. And I specifically talked about Billie Holiday and some other artists such as Anita O'Day, who gave specific quotes about how she would go the glamour route to avoid being associated as a junkie or heroin addict. And Anita O'Day, thank goodness, she lived to she lived to her 80s, and she wrote a fabulous book about her life growing up as a jazz singer, and also she was very honest about her drug addiction and her heroin use.
Well, and what's interesting is she's pretty honest about it, but she sort of says that she used glamour as a kind of distraction from what her life was really about.
Yeah. And for Billie Holiday never gave too many, she didn't really discuss in great detail her drug usage as Anita O'Day did. But as I mentioned, as you started with that, Billie Holiday definitely wore long gloves to conceal track marks on her arms. And during this period of the 40s, primarily the 40s, drug addiction was considered a crime. There was no thing called rehabilitation. So they would lock up the drug user and send them to jail without any type of rehabilitation. So they had these artists such as Anita O'Day, even Charlie Parker.
I was going to ask you about
Charlie Parker wore suits to kind of conceal his addiction. Sometimes you couldn't conceal it. If you're sweating on the stage or if you're rocking back and forth, people still know that you're fixed. But appearance and garments were used to conceal their addiction. And oftentimes there were police or cops in the audience. So that was their way of saying that, no, visually I'm normal, you know.
Well, let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Alfonso McClendon. And again, we're talking about his new book. It's called Fashion and Jazz. And it's a bit of a walk through history, looking at the roots of both fashion and jazz and how they intersected together, talking about people like Billie Holiday, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You also talk about the introduction of the fur coat. Ella Fitzgerald wearing her fur coat, other singers wearing fur coats as well. I guess reaching a certain period in their career where they had money and they wanted people to see them dress well.
Yeah. Yeah, I just recently did a presentation or lecture on this. I called it Jazz Ladies and Mink Coats, Fashioning Modern Identities in Jim Crow America. So in the 30s and 40s, fur coats have always, you know, were greatly in demand, whether you're a jazz artist or not. It was just the popular trend of the day. But in this lecture, I really talk about how the jazz ladies, specifically African Americans, used it to gain acceptance in an environment where they were considered less than or not equals. So in a sense, them putting on mink coats allowed them to walk into a venue and say, you know, you may not treat me like I'm an equal, but I'm going to show you visually that I am equal to you. The only difference may be skin color. And for one example, Dinah Washington played Vegas during its Jim Crow era. And she was at the Sahara and she had to have a trailer hitched to the back of the stage because she could only enter through the kitchen. And she could, most of these jazz artists like Billy's and others, and also, you know, Dinah Washington, they could not go into the audience either. So Dinah Washington loved fur coats. She had many, many, many fur coats. She's probably the queen of fur coats in addition to the queen of the blues. So for Dinah Washington, fur was a way to, you know, say that I'm an equal.
Mm-hmm.
And these greats always say that, I say the jazz performers are the unsung heroes of the civil rights movement. A lot of them died, like Billie Holiday, before the main part of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. But Billie had to suffer a lot of
She suffered a lot of things. She suffered in her life.
Yeah, she suffered a lot in her life. Playing clubs where, again, as I mentioned earlier, you could play on the bandstand, but you couldn't go into the audience and mingle. And so they fought in a different way that sometimes is not acknowledged. But Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington one time was refused out in L.A. He was able to sit at a restaurant, but they wouldn't serve him food. And so these are the people prior, sometimes 10, 20 years before the civil rights movement, they were fighting in society.
Let's talk a bit. Sure. Let's talk a bit about Dizzy Gillespie. You have a photo in here. You know, it's a great looking striped suit. He's got the goatee. He's got the dark glasses. Yeah. I mean, he knew how to dress.
Yes. Yeah. Dizzy Gillespie was from South Carolina. And then he moved to, actually, he lived in Philadelphia. And actually, he hung out at Fairmont Park. So we have a great connection with Dizzy Gillespie in Philadelphia. He was inspired by Duke Ellington. He talks about in his book how he used to listen to Duke Ellington on the radio while he was playing at the Cotton Club, if it was a broadcast. But he gave the most notable period we know about Dizzy Gillespie is once he started wearing the horn-rimmed glasses, the goatee, and the beret.
I was going to say the beret, yeah.
And some at that time were saying, you know, some of the jazz critics said that he was putting like a comical twist on jazz. And Dizzy Gillespie honestly says in his biography, that he started to do those things for more utilitarian function. He said that the goatee actually allowed him to rest his instrument. He said his horn-rimmed glasses, or sometimes he wore sunglasses, in the clubs, and they thought it was him being like, you know, trying to be a celebrity. And he says no, because the lights were bright and he needed the sunglasses to kind of shade the bright lights. So a lot of his dress sometimes was utilitarian as well.
And would you say that these jazz musicians, I mean, that they had a big influence on fashion even beyond jazz aficionados?
Yeah. Jazz and fashion, I say they have a symbiotic relationship. They feed off one another. You know, jazz artists took fashion and they kind of manipulated it. And then it would go back to the fashion designers. And then they would say, oh, I'm inspired by how Billie Holiday looks. Mm-hmm. I'm inspired by Sarah Vaughan. I'm inspired by Dizzy Gillespie and his goatee. And I'm going to kind of give a twist on it. And some of the designers nowadays are still going back to certain periods. We know right now the 70s are very big for the spring and summer.
Yeah, you just rolled your eyes when you said that.
Yeah, no, it's actually very cool. If you look at any of the magazines right now, you'll see like it's very 70s. So the men are wearing some of the models in the magazines like GQ and Detail. Their lapels are very wide and they have top stitching on them. It looks very 1970s, like a polyester suit. So, but they'll often reference the 1940s, the 1950s.
Talk a bit about the zoot suit, and then we'll get some callers in on the conversation. Where does that come from, and how does that fit into this jazz?
Yeah, the zoot suit really started from the double-breasted suit. So the double-breasted suit was pretty much at the started around the late 30s into all of the 1940s. Men wore pretty much double-breasted suits, kind of the Mad Men era, a little earlier than the Mad Men era. But what happened is the youth took the double-breasted suit and they started to exaggerate it. They started to widen lapel. They started to peg the trousers. The waistband had a lot of volume that was cinched in. Also, the waistband started to raise up, so it came to the stomach. And then around the early 1940s, around 42, 43, a lot of Latinos in L.A. were wearing this look, and they started to have battles with the sailors out in L.A., and it's called the Zoot Suit Riots. And that's when the Zoot Suit starts to take on a subversive manner. Hmm. They start to consider it, one, that it was using a lot of fabric, and this was the war years when you could not waste fabric.
And it's a big, wide
jacket.
It's
a big, wide suit. And so the sailors didn't like that. They felt that it was being, you know, using up the fabric. It was against the war effort. So then there's confrontation, the Zoot Suit Riot with the Latinos and the sailors. And then also a lot of young African-American men up in Harlem at the Savoy Ballroom, they wore the Zoot Suit. And so the Zoot Suit starts to become anti-society. And also in much the same way that we see men nowadays when they wear their pants sagging or they twist their hat to the back, it's subversive. It's against the norms of society and it becomes confrontational.
Do you think the Zoot Suit will ever come back? Or has it made little mini appearances every now and then?
I think everything in fashion can be repeatable. So I think in some manner or form, it will come back. And actually, we saw it come back during the MC Hammer era, which is pretty much a form of the Zoot Suit.
We have an email from Patrick. Says, lovely educational, inspirational program as a jazz aficionado. And like fashion from Ghana, the artists made sure they're in their tuxedos to impress their affluent listeners. I guess, yes. I mean, clearly, as you said, there is a racial element to what you're talking about, because so many black performers could only perform in certain venues.
Yes.
They couldn't stay in certain hotels, eat in certain restaurants, but they could dress.
Yeah. And he brings up a great point about affluence, that the tuxedo, the history of the tuxedo is that around the late 1800s, the tuxedo became popular. And it's like, where did it come from? So what men used to wear, smoking jackets, and they also wore long tail jackets. So there's a story on the Laura Lard family, which is in New York, Griswold, Laura Lard. The story goes, we can't necessarily give him credit for the tuxedo, but they came back from Europe and they started wearing, they removed the tails from their jacket. Uh-huh. And they also started to wear satin on their lapels or satin stripes. So they started to no longer wear long tails at formal occasions. And so the place where it happened was Tuxedo Hall, New York. I'm probably saying that wrong. Tuxedo, New York. And that's where the name tuxedo comes from.
Yeah. But also for musicians, I mean, if you have long tails, it's harder to move. I'm assuming that the shorter tuxedo gave them the sort of mobility that they needed to play.
Yeah, it was more mobility. And it's also good. Again, fashion always pushes for modernity. So it's also advancing. So in much the same way women wanted to wear shorter skirts so they could move around, they could ride in cars, get in and out of cars. The tuxedo, the tails were removed. And you'll see when Duke Ellington sits down in the 1920s at a piano, he always has to push or kick back his tuxedo tails so he doesn't sit on them at the piano. So
you have a great picture here. It's actually from 1950. It's a Jelly Roll Morton. He's playing or actually wearing a Norfolk style jacket in a publicity photo. It's and you talk a bit about going from, I guess, the knickers to the long pants. That was a big deal back then.
Yeah.
100 years ago.
Yeah, I always say Jelly Roll Morton was the first celebrity. he always said that.
It's a great photo, by the
yeah.
way.
There's a lot. He claims that in a lot of books, it says that he claims that he, you know, pretty much invented jazz. So he always wants to take he wanted to take credit for jazz. But he was a great first celebrity. As that picture in the book, he, you know, it's like a publicity photograph that he often signed. You can probably see some of his signature in the corner. But he was a great jazz player of the ragtime period. Great style. He moved out of New Orleans. He was actually Creole, and he moved out of New Orleans, went to he spent some time in L.A., Chicago, and I think he was also in New York for some time.
And clearly a good dresser.
Yeah, a good dresser. And I like that reminds me when you talk about the short pants or the knee breeches. Count Basie, I have a quote in there that he talked about that you had to wear short pants to a certain age. You couldn't wear long pants until you became a teenager, you know, pretty much an adult. So a lot of the guys during the 1920s always wanted to start wearing sailor pants or long pants before their time. And when they did it, the adults or the older generation would wave their fingers and say, no, no, no. And they said it wasn't considered subversive, but they just said that it was them trying to be mannish and grown up.
And that's Alfonso McClendon. We're talking about jazz and fashion, or fashion and jazz, the title of his book. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. That's Free by Ornette Coleman. And we are talking about jazz and fashion in this hour of Radio Times. And our guest, Alfonso McClendon, says not only were these musicians great musicians, many of them were very snappy dressers, if I can put it that way. And he teaches at Drexel University. And you can join the conversation. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We have a very patient caller, Samantha from Bryn Mawr, that wants to join the conversation. Samantha, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this was really interesting. I happened to catch it driving home, but my question was in reference to an earlier comment about how fashion in the 90s, how the models were like the heroin chic coming
yes.
off of Cindy Crawford, Elle McPherson, and whatnot, and I just wondered if the guest had any data that showed why that fashion went in that direction, because it also made me think of Kurt Cobain and Nirvana and the heroine of the grunge rock. So, yeah, I'll leave it at that because
sure.
someone just rear-ended me, actually.
Oh, dear. Pull over, Samantha. Take care of yourself. And let me give...
Well, I'm in a parking lot, so that's even better.
So, okay, as long as you're okay.
Well, I'll listen to it off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Well, this is live radio. Someone calling in from a car in a parking lot, I'm happy to say, but it sounds like she just got rear-ended.
Oh, wow.
So, Samantha, do take care of that. Alfonso, I mean, it's an interesting, it's a little bit beyond the book, but this whole notion of fashion chic.
Yeah, the chapter, I really trace the chapter on fashionable addiction, Path to Heroin Chic. I do trace, and I touch on what she talks about, Kurt Cobain. And really, the reason that it changed from the 1980s was a very happy period. It's about stock market, Wall Street, about big spending, flashy clothes. And when we went to the 90s, a lot of things started to happen. The first World Trade Center bombing, the federal mural building explosion, bombing happened in Oklahoma. And so society kind of changed, and the fashion world took on this kind of more darker feeling. And so that's kind of what led to heroin chic. And even you look at the movies of the time, they start to become darker. We have Pulp Fiction, and they also start to, the Basketball Diaries starring Leonardo DiCaprio. So all that kind of fashion always kind of reflects society and things that are going on. So that's why it shifted from a happy, lighthearted to a more dark, somber aesthetic.
Samantha, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Before we get back to our callers, you have a section in here basically saying, you know, Philadelphia is a jazz city, but in many ways an unsung jazz city. It doesn't get the attention or perhaps the accolades that other cities have gotten.
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, I don't want to say that it's definitely a great supporter of jazz, more so than any other cities. But what I feel sometimes we don't have the monuments to say, oh, Dizzy Gillespie came through here, John Coltrane came through here, Billie Holiday was born here. Bessie Smith is buried here. And I went to, in researching this book, I went to her memorial. It's in Sharon Hill, PA. It's nothing fabulous and spectacular, you would think. She's kind of buried, you know, kind of in the back of the cemetery. And for a long time, she didn't have a marker on her grave. And Janis Joplin, before her death in the 70s, 1970, she put a marker on Bessie Smith's grave, and they did like a retribute. So I felt I had to go pay respect to Bessie Smith and go there. And also another part of the book, the last chapter of the book, second to last chapter, I really investigated the jazz venues starting in 1915 up through 1960 that decorated the city. And I found so many fabulous clubs in different parts of the city. Sometimes the clubs would shift from South Philly to North Philly, to West Philly. Some of the memorable names that I saw were the Mickey Mouse Club in South Philadelphia. There's the Wonder Bar in North Philly. There was the Ridge Cotton Club on Ridge Avenue. Ridge Avenue was kind of a key entertainment district there in the 1930s. There were so many jazz venues, and they all advertised in the Philadelphia Tribune. And they had to, each period was different. In the 1920s, we had prohibition, so they couldn't sell alcohol. So they had to entertain the people with live floor shows, much like the Cotton Club. Then in the 1930s, it shifted again, and it was all about like having food and entertainment. And then in the 40s, it's about, we see that people stop dancing. Dancing becomes no longer hip anymore. And so what people start to sit down and listen to the music. Right. And that's when you start to have quartets, septets, and small combos that entertain.
Well, you have a great quote. This is the Philadelphia Tribune, a newspaper that still exists today,
yes.
1926, and this is a description of the Palais Royal, the finest colored ballroom in America. Going to a dance today is a social occasion where one meets his friends, makes new acquaintances. Beauty and a distinctive atmosphere are of prime importance in supplying the charm, which often goes to create fond and lasting memories of such occasions.
Yes.
And I'm sure people got dressed up really nicely.
They did. When you look at all the advertisements for these clubs, it's all about social mingling. It's about providing fine foods and fine drinks for people, providing the best entertainment. They had spectacular floor shows. And then in the 40s, a lot of these places did broadcasting on the radio. So that's the part that I feel like we miss when you go around Philadelphia. And some of these clubs, obviously the names are changed, but I know over in West Philly, I think near Haverford, one of the clubs that I investigated is still there. Obviously, the name's changed, but the building is still there. It's, I think, 639. Don't quote me, but but that's the history that I feel sometimes the younger generation misses out on, as the rich history of Philadelphia from the African-American jazz perspective.
And was there fashion in Philly associated with that, or is that almost too sort of narrow a place to have its own design, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, there was no... I would say that fashion was really as far as retail. Obviously, you had the Wanamakers and Strawbridges and that type of retail. But as far as design, it was probably more small scale in the African American community. It's probably designers who were here. But really, what I saw most was like the retailing and the dissemination of fashion. It's like when I was looking at South Philadelphia in the 1920s, these fabulous tailors were targeting African-American men. They were saying, we have the suits, we have the snappy suits that you want. And they start to use these words, this kind of like
snappy,
what I call like social media, these snappy words of like branding. So snappy guys wanted snappy suits in the 1920s. And they said, we have all the types that will satisfy you. So that was actually, some of them were white retailers actually targeting African-American consumers.
Well, I happen to like the word snappy, even today. Let me get Kathleen from Maniunk to join our conversation. Hi, Kathleen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I'm really enjoying the show. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
I had two questions. One was about, I forget the name of the artist that wore that signature pork pie hat. And the other is if there is in this book an entire chapter on Miles Davis.
Two good questions there. Yeah. Kathleen, go ahead.
Yeah.
Pork pie hat.
The artist that wore the pork pie hat was Lester Young. And Lester Young was a Lester Young and Billie Holiday are often quoted together or cited together because they were like, they were great friends. They kind of fell out, and then they actually died in the same year, in 1959. And both of them traveled with Count Basie in the late mid-30s. And so that's how those two are always associated together, Count Basie, Lester Young, and Billie Holiday. Mm. And then your second question about Miles Davis. I don't have a whole chapter on him, but I do discuss and quote a lot of Miles Davis when I on my chapter on fashionable addiction and also on the dress of jazz artists, because in his book he talks a lot about his Brooks Brothers suits that he would wear, and he was of the period where kind of like the zoot suits, or he didn't really wear zoot suits, but more what I would call double-breasted wide lapel suits. So he's an important person to quote in that when I'm talking about those subjects.
Kathleen, thanks for the call. Let's see what Kathy from Lansdowne has to say. Kathy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you so much for bringing us these in-depth programs on music, especially with the Philadelphia angle.
Oh, and, sure. Our pleasure.
Well, I have a story. I have studied and taught the early vintage dances from the ragtime period before the First World War, and also the fashions. And while I was doing that, I came across a collector of piano rolls whose grandmother used to attend the very fancy private New York, say, Vanderbilt private parties where they were starting to do the ragtime dances. Mm-hmm. And he said that the dresses were so flimsy and silky and almost see-through, very few survive to today, that they employed a seamstress because the ladies didn't make it through the night. Between the silkiness of the dresses and the wildness of the dances, they needed to be repaired. And perhaps the dress might make it through one evening. Mm-hmm. And I just thought you might find that...
That's fascinating.
Yes, I found it fascinating. Also, very few survive. These are the dresses that Mrs. Castle... Irene Castle pioneered, the woman who's fashion for cutting her hair so she could dance became the rage all over the world.
Well, Kathy, I appreciate
thank you very much for this program.
Well, thank you for your question, and go ahead. Do you want to add to what she said?
Yeah, I wanted to just add that. Yeah, interesting. During the 1920s, when they opened Tutankhamun's tomb, it also influenced fashion, and that's why a lot of the dresses of that time period, almost some of them have like an Egyptian, very flimsy fabric, see-through, lace. And I have a quote from a pastor during that time, and he said that the fashion, he's talking about the 1920s fashions for women, and saying that some of these fashions take us back into time when women lost their morals.
Oh.
So the women that were wearing those dresses and dancing in those provocative ways during the Charleston and the Bambula and some of these other kind of dances that originated, some of them from African dance, were provocative to the norms and traditions, especially Victorian society.
Well, and by design, wouldn't you say? I mean, the idea was to push against all those rules and regulations. Kathy, thanks for the call. Let's see what Will from Pleasantville has to say. Will, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Great program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to point out a fact that, historical fact, blacks, even up to this day, they couldn't participate with the American dream because, redlining. They couldn't get the homes with the picket fence. They didn't have the jobs that could, afford them a home. So a lot of times if blacks had money, they would put their money in fashion. Not just the musicians, but just the average black. And I was one of them. I'm a musician myself. And I observed that over many years. And I also want to point out one historical fact I read many years ago. They said that fashion was started many years ago by a musician. They said at one time they just wore these cloaks in one particular color. And I think it was an Italian musician, and he started wearing these cloaks in different colors. And that was the beginning of the fashion industry, and it started with a musician. I will take my answer off the phone. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Well, thanks for the call to Radio Times. An interesting point that if you can't buy a house somewhere, you can't get a job somewhere, you can dress.
It's in a way to express yourself. And actually, I went back. I studied, I read a lot of the slave narratives. We know that in the late 30s, there was a WPA Works Projects project sponsored by the government, and they sent a lot of people, writers, into the South to record the narratives of the slaves. So reading a lot of the slave narratives, you'll see some of the former slaves mention how their parents would take the clothing that was left to them and make it more beautiful, aesthetically pleasing. So they would find all types of techniques they would go and pull flowers and dye and create their own dyes. So from way back when, we see that African-Americans during the slave period, that they found ways to improvise, and when they didn't have anything, and to take the clothes. And also during that time is when they started improvising with dances. And we know that's they mentioned in the slave narratives that the cakewalk kind of comes from the slave period, where they would have dances when they could assemble, and they would have dance contests, and the prize would get a cake. Because that's where the cakewalk comes from.
Oh, that's where the cakewalk came. Yes. And obviously jazz, all about improvisation.
Yeah, and a lot of times when they were dancing during this cakewalk, sometimes they would imitate the formal manners of the plantation owners. And so that's pretty much what the cakewalk is. It's a way of dancing, a comical way of dancing that's kind of, you're pretending like you're really affluent, formal manner of waltzes and quadrilles, and then they start to dance in a comical manner. So that's the cakewalk in the ragtime.
This is your first book that you've written, and you also made the transition from the world of fashion and design to the world of academia. Was that a tricky transition for you?
Yeah. I was able to, not too much of a, it's a definitely two different fields. Actually, in my teaching, I rely on my industry experience. I traveled around the world extensively in Asia, and Taiwan, and Japan. So what I love about being in the academy now is that I'm able to really, research, dig into these archives, and kind of, I always wanted to leave something behind, and I feel like I've done that, at least with my first book so far, is to really leave something meaningful behind with my name on it, and really giving back to society and teaching the younger generation that the things they're experiencing now, we see a lot of this angst and turmoil right now in different parts of the country. And we see that a lot of this is nothing new, that it's gone on before. And there's, been different ways of expression and different ways to seek for modernity and advancement.
Alfonso McClendon, thanks very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's assistant professor at Drexel University's Westfall College of Media, Arts, and Design. And again, he's got a new book. It's called Fashion and Jazz. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to listen on satellite radio, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.